Hi, I'm Andrew Rich, and if you're like me, you look at the state of modern wrestling discourse and think, wow, what a cesspool. That's why I'm here to tell you about Music of the Mat Remix. That's right, your favorite wrestling music podcast is back with a new format, where I bring on a guest and we play songs related to wrestling-themed topics. It could be a wrestling reference, a wrestling concept, a wrestling pun, things of that nature. Now you might be saying, Andrew, that is a very, very tenuous connection to pro wrestling on a wrestling podcast network. Is this just an excuse to hang out with your friends and talk about music and ignore the rest of the wrestling landscape? Yes. Yes, it is. So listen to Music of the Mat Remix on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network, available on Apple, Spotify, or your podcast player of choice.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Welcome back to Those Days, a Michinoku Pro Retrospective. Episode 13, Michinoku's UK Excursion. Those Days is brought to you by Open the Voice Gate and the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You can find Those Days on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network feed or on the dedicated Open the Voice Gate feed wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow Open the Voice Gate on social media at Open Voice Gate. And if you'd like to donate to the show, click the link in our show notes to our redcircle.com landing site. You click the red box that says sponsor this podcast and you set up a one-time or reoccurring donation. No obligation whatsoever, but we would like to thank our previous donors. I'm one of your hosts. It's your old pal, Mike Spears, joined alongside your other host, Case Lowe. And Case, we're in 1996 already with this episode, and because of kind of where we are on the calendar, I feel like that we have to look back at 1995 before we get into 1996 and one of the more publicly noteworthy years in the history of Michinoku Pro.
It's the year, you know. I think anybody that's followed along in this journey has been waiting for us to get to this point. I'm very glad that it only took us 13 episodes to get here. I feel like we made really good pace through 93, 94, 95. I look forward to going really in depth into 96. I keep on telling people, I think I was about a month ago sitting down and plotting out the 1997 episodes, and there was just some outrageous stuff in the timeline in 1997 that I'm really looking forward to getting into. And then before you know it, we'll sort of be at the end of our run here. So I don't know if this is going to be exactly the halfway point of Those Days, but we are certainly now shifting into what would be recognized as the peak of Michinoku Pro, the prime of Michinoku Pro, and our understanding of this promotion as we sit here recording in the first quarter of 2026 is largely shaped off the material that we're reviewing from now 30 years ago.
Yeah, and at least the way that I kind of look at it, you've been the one more producing and plotting out how the run of this is going to go. I kind of look at this as a story in three acts, and really 92, 93, and 94, and into 1995, maybe starting maybe the end of the first act is the first Fukuman Mask League. But I feel like that now we're into 1996, we are kind of in this mature position for Michinoku Pro, and especially as it relates for our kind of story. But I feel like that this is kind of the climactic actions happening very fast and furious, and then before you know it, we're on to Act 3 in 1998. And I don't know if it's something that we're going to be probably going to this kind of six episodes per calendar year as it relates to Michinoku Pro format outside of 1996 and 1997. But I feel like that we're still like not at exactly where I would consider the halfway point, maybe. I mean, it matters how much you're looking at Jacob 2000, really.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at it now, and if we stay on schedule, there are six episodes in 1996. I would imagine there's probably six in 1997 as well. But then 98, 99, I mean, you and I are going to be talking a lot of Crazy Max, but that is where some of the footage either thins out, or some of the footage, at least based on my previous viewings, is maybe not worth diving super deep into. Whereas, you know, 1996, and we'll talk about it as we go along, and we'll make sure that everybody can see this footage that wants to see this footage, but it's largely based on a few different comp tapes. And if you follow those comp tapes, you can follow along with this promotion pretty easily. You know, I think this is maybe the episode where things are the most scattered about. You know, we had to track down some footage for this episode that wasn't previously online, and we'll make that available for everybody. The Michinoku Pro UK excursion, the 1 hour comp tape that was there. And then we've got two episodes of Michinoku Pro TV to talk about as well. But we're here. I'm excited. Again, this is sort of, I would imagine the guys that do the ROH Years podcast felt this way when they got into 2006 and 2007. You know, this is, like I said, my reason for doing this podcast was I wanted to tell the story of Michinoku Pro outside of 1996. And that is still the overarching goal here. And I'm very proud of those early episodes, you know, talking about the foundation of and formation of Michinoku Pro and how we got here. But also, just as somebody that has watched a lot of the footage that's available from this year, now that we're in 1996, I am quite excited to dive into it again.
Yep, absolutely. Me too. And I think that before we get into 1996 proper, we got to close out 1995 and talk about the awards and our picks from at least for Michinoku's 1995. And with that case, we go straight to the Observer in 1996.
We do. So we're going to put a bow on 1995 here. Before I break down where Michinoku Pro and their wrestlers fared in the Observer Awards, I do want to ask you just your overarching thoughts on 1995. I think that is one of those years where, you know, if 93 is defined by the beginning and the car park show and Delphin versus Sasuke and that feud, and 1994 is this mainstream surgence of great Sasuke because of the J Cup in a way that nobody could have possibly predicted. And, you know, the year ends with Sasuke versus Onita and Sasuke versus Taka. 1995 feels a little bit like the lost year in the early years of Michinoku Pro. Right. At least that's the way that I approached it going into it. Having now watched all of the footage that is available, how would you describe 1995? How would you define 1995? Did your view of that year change at all after watching everything in chronological order for this podcast?
Well, I thought 1995 was going to be a growing pains kind of year just because of the peak that, at least if you look at Sasuke in his 1994, I mean, we talked in depth about how it stands as a great junior heavyweight year of wrestling. And I feel like that really bolstered the 1994. 1995, I figure the departure of Jinsei Shinzaki and how that everything really kicked off in 96, but of course with like Fukumen and Dos Caras coming in, I did know that there was still meat on the bone there. But after going through 1995, and as we now are able to look back on it, I think 1995 turns into the story of Plan B's, essentially, because at least when I was constructing like who my wrestlers of Michinoku's year were in 1995 and of the matches of it, and you compare it to 93 and 94, like the thing that becomes very apparent is that this is a year that there's virtually no Sato. You do have the win over Delphin, but he's essentially out of the picture the entire year. Delphin is a bigger discussion point of his output. So what does 1995 become when Sato goes out there and then essentially Kai and Tai gets put on ice for 9 months until he returns in 96? What do they do? It becomes really a conversation of how they've started to really flesh out the remainder of the roster. I think that 1995 becomes, in a lot of ways, the year of Taka Michinoku. I think that Grand Nanawa has an incredible 1995. So Whereas 1994, you have all of those Sasuke headlines, and you have Sato versus Delphin, and you do get a little bit of that in 1995. The year ultimately kind of results into, okay, optioning away from that, who are the people who are really making the steps forwards? And it's those guys who really were the young rookies in 1993, and people like Taka.
Yeah, I'm with you. I have the same takeaway. You know, it's a year where Taka, I think, goes from bubbling under the surface to being a legitimately great wrestler, and that is represented to some degree in the Observer Awards. I think it's a year where Hoshikawa takes a giant step forward. You see Funaki make his presence felt on these cards. You have the Convict, who I'll rave about again here. And then at the end of the year, you get the inclusion addition of Tiger Mask onto the roster, and before you know it, yeah, I mean, 1994 is a pretty top heavy promotion. It's Shinzaki, it's Delphin, it's Sasuke. If you're lucky, you get some big Sato matches on tape. But by 95, it's a card that has a lot of young, exciting wrestlers, and so you not only have the continued daredevil antics of Sasuke, which are prevalent in January of 1996, as we will discuss. You know, that sort of stuff is still the hallmark of the promotion. But what I really like is the sort of lightweight, bantamweight style wrestling that begins to form here in 1995 with Taka and with Hoshikawa. And with some of the stuff that Nanawa is doing, with some of the stuff that Funaki's doing, it is a promotion that feels very much of a time in 1995, but that time is a good time where you're seeing now not only the foundation of Hamada's Universal and the training that went on there, but now you're starting to see, you know, these guys partner up with Pro Wrestling Fujiwara Gumi and then later Battle Arts, and you start to see the sort of really advanced grappling also make its way into Michinoku Pro. And that's one of the things that as we go along here, especially as we remove ourselves from 96, remove ourselves from 97, and especially once you see Kai and Tai leave the promotion, that's what I'm really curious about is, did they try and fail with Hoshikawa? Was Hoshikawa not a guy that could carry a promotion? You know, what's the deal with Yakushiji in terms of his star power? Like, there's all these things that I'm trying to figure out, because as you sit here in 1995, for what the promotion is and with the roster, the size that it is, it actually is a promotion that has pretty deep depth at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I'm flipping through my notes for our 1995, and you even go to positions where, like, people like Yakushiji, who, I mean, he is, like, one of the favorites that, like, 1996, if we're talking about things that I'm really going to be paying attention to over the next six episodes, it's going to be like, okay, 1995 was the year that Taka and Hoshikawa really took that step forward, and that they weren't either being the Lost Boys in Taka's, the Lost Boys Piranha in Taka's case, or essentially doing undercard duty or being tethered to Wellington Wilkins. Like, 1995 was their chance to make that step. In 1996, that's where I'm looking for Yakushiji. But I mean, even like looking at like the front of the card here, I'm looking at June 17th, 1995, the Chachunga Chukako 1995 show from Fukushima. Yakushiji versus Talisman, I have at like 3.5 stars as like an opener. And when that's something that's not happening in 1994, that's something that nothing even comes close to in 1993. So I think what you see here is that now you really have this core of about 12 guys on this roster. And there's even like moments from like people like Yone Genjin that I feel like that he has that niche. And it's like, now I feel like in 1995 is sometimes the best examples of that niche. And then you look at the bottom end there, and it's really kind of interesting to see like the people like Nanawa's 1995, considering that Nanawa 17 and 18 across this year is like case. It's insane the huge step forward that he makes in this year, considering his age. And I'll just say it just like right here. I think that he has one of what I think will be one of the top five matches throughout the history of the promotion coming out this year. And he's having this in 1995 in his 17 and 18 year old year.
You know, when you compare it to Toriumon, the story that's always told, and it's the correct story to tell, is that you have your first tour in January and February of 99. They come back in April. They have their shows in June and July that build up to the first Kobe World. And that is a promotion that at that point is entirely dominated by either A, what Crazy Max is doing, or B, what Magnum Tokyo is doing. And so it's still just that first class of students that are really dominating. And you have, you know, friends of Ultimo Dragon. I mean, Grand Hamada being one of them, filling out those cards, especially on those big shows. In September of 1999, that September 14th, 1999 show, you have the opening match with Genki Horiguchi and Susumu Yokosuka. And that's the first time that Toriumon is sort of put on the map as, oh, there's something else happening here. This roster actually is not just Shima. It's not just Magnum. Like, all of these kids seem like they can go. And it's interesting that we don't really have that in Michinoku. I mean, I'm looking here at my big Michinoku spreadsheet, which I guess I should probably put in the Discord because there's a lot of match recommendations on this thing. But there's just not a lot, like you said, of 3.25 but really exciting, or 3.5-star and over delivering, or 3.75 and almost great sort of undercard matches in this promotion. Not really until you get to 95. When I'm looking here at, you know, my 1993 match guide, it's Sato and Delphin and Sasuke and Shinzaki. And in 1994, it's Sato and Delphin and Sasuke and Shinzaki. And then towards the end of the year, kind of Taka. In 1995, it's a much more diverse group of names.
Yeah, and it's really kind of this year. I don't look at it as this step back year, because the more you kind of get into it, the more you're like, the big takeaway I actually kind of have, and the big question that I have coming out in 1995, case, and this is a pure hypothetical, what would we be saying about 1995 if Taka was given a one-off gimmick and let to be in the Fukumen Mask League? And considering we don't get essentially one whole episode of Taka on this program, we don't get a whole episode of Terry Boy either. Just like, imagine like what Taka, what he does in 1995, if you were able to add in a good focus in the Mask League with to it as well.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You know, Taka in the Mask League, I think it would have been interesting had Tiger Mask made his debut in that Mask League. We don't really get that. And so
we don't really get the Tag League, which we would have gotten a lot of Dream Chasers too for Taka.
Yeah, I really like that 1995 Tag League field. Let me see just real quick if I can pull that up, because that was won by Kato Kung Lee and Great Sasuke. We talked about that last week. And then Nanawa Delphin, Nakajima Hoshikawa, Funaki Taka, and the Convict and Yone Genjin, which I would imagine those matches would be pretty weak. But nevertheless, the other teams of that tournament are pretty solid. I should tell you now, Mike, I'm mulling over the idea of our next episode covering with footage, because as I do a quick search, I see that it's available, the Yone Genjin and CMLL excursion in the spring of 1996. We might have to watch these matches.
I think we have to.
There's a CMLL welterweight title tournament match, which we will talk this episode, and especially the next episode, actually a lot about the CMLL welterweight title. There's a Cyclone Ramirez versus Yone Genjin match, and then there is a 26-minute YouTube video trios match of Americo Rocco, Astro Ray Jr., and Yone Genjin versus Cyclone Ramirez, El Justercio, and Olympus. And I just feel like,
yeah,
we might have to watch those.
I mean, I think that if we're going to give an accurate portrayal of the rise and fall of Michinoku Pro, we have to talk about Yone Genjin CMLL excursion. Because the thing that kind of, like, you say that Genjin and Superboy / the Convict might have been like the weaker team, but those have been tougher matches. I think I would have love to see those, because I feel like you get Genjin away from Wilkins, and maybe, yeah, the times that we got to see that a little bit in 1995, I have some time that I would want to kind of give it a fair shot there, because maybe Yone Genjin, just because he's always stuck doing the Wilkins brawls, maybe he is the secret mad genius that comes alive in CMLL.
I mean, I guess I can't rule that out, because two episodes from now, we'll have to talk about Sasuke going back to CMLL, this time with Tiger Mask. And there's two Sasuke matches that we'll have to cover. There's a six-man with Sasuke, Tiger Mask, and Atlantis versus Negro Casas, Dr. Wagner Jr., and El Satanico. And then the next night, they do Sasuke versus Negro Casas in a singles match. So we'll cover those, absolutely. But I don't know if we're going to cover Sasuke and CMLL. we'd be foolish not to cover Yone Genjin in CMLL. I mean, I said we were in 1993 and Sato Diktogo was going back and forth between Mexico and Japan and working all those UWA shows. I mean, God, I wish we had that footage because we would have really sunk our teeth into those, but we didn't get it. So I kind of feel like to make up for it, we have to do the Yone Genjin stuff here.
I mean, we already have him doing commercials for Michinoku Pro in 1995. Maybe, like, I think we need to get into, like, a deeper understanding of this. Like, I'm not saying we need to go and then watch all the Wilkins matches he has with after this, but at least for this, I think that this is maybe like we're giving him an independent study here, and maybe he knocks it out of the park and we go like, okay, Yone Genjin, welcome to the Good Boys Club with everyone else. Or at this point we can know to basically not waste our time with him from now on.
This is good. I'm adding this to the episode 14 notes as we will talk about great matches such as the Great Sasuke versus Jushin Thunder Liger and the formation of Kai and Tai DX. We'll also talk about Yone Genjin and CMLL, so you have that to look forward to the next time on those days.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
Let's talk about these 1995 Observer Awards. What I'll do here is I'm going to go through category by category anytime that a Michinoku pro wrestler placed in one of these categories, and then before I get your thoughts, let's go one category at a time because there's a larger point that I want to make. But best flying wrestler is the first time that we see Michinoku pop up here. It is won by Rey Mysterio Jr., second place Great Sasuke, and then followed by Sabu, Manami, Toyota, Psychosis, your top five. Hayabusa finishes seventh, Jushin Thunder Liger eighth, and an honorable mention for Ultimo Dragon, just to name a few. You think about 1995, that is the rapid growth of AAA and the real formative year for Rey Mysterio Jr. I think it's impressive that Sasuke finished ahead of Sabu and ahead of Toyota, and that feels like a very fair award. It's very fair second place for Sasuke.
Yeah, like especially when you consider like the rest of the field, their Liger is out for a lot of 95. Otani is starting to scrap up there, and like the fact that at least do we know if this was 3-2-1 or like 5-3-1 or top five for this? Because Sasuke only has 11 first place votes, but he still finishes second. And that out of the people who all receive first place votes, which is everyone on that list other than Too Cold Scorpio, Sasuke has the third least other than Liger and Otani. So Sasuke is virtually everyone's number two, mm-hmm. is my guess.
Yeah, and that feels like balloting that went Rey 1, Sasuke 2, and then whoever else number 3.
Right, and I think if you look like at the point difference, I mean, he has double Sabu and Manami Toyotas. So I think that's kind of how that has to go when you look at it.
Most underrated that year, it was won by Skip of the WWF. Second place, Al Snow. Third place, Dean Malenko. Fourth place, Takashi Iizuka. Fifth place, Hakushi, which we'll get to him a little bit more later in this episode. And then an honorable mention for Taka Michinoku, which I think is interesting that by 95, you are not alone in your thought of like, kind of wish Taka had a little bit more to do. The Observer readers would agree with you as well.
Yeah. The ball knowers knew about Taka in 95. I do love the fact for Skip. It's like, all right, it's nice to see Candido make that list. You know, like I forget that sometimes Chris Candido and like his career and then Iizuka before he went insane, like being like the tag team partner that went to WCW against the Steiners, I think. Was that in 95?
Oh, God, you're asking the wrong guy.
Yeah, no. I'm trying to contextualize Takashi Iizuka's presence on this list for someone who might only be aware from him as Crazy Guy of Steel Fingers, who retired like 5 years ago.
Yep, and Al Snow, our favorite first responder, also most underrated there, which is shocking to look at in 2026 eyes, but nevertheless, readers' personal favorite. Go ahead.
I was going to say, 95 for like Al Snow and Dean Malenko, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, especially if ECW at that point.
Yeah, oh my God, yeah. I mean, and it's a really interesting list. Going over these, maybe kind of want to figure out something to do with these old Observer Awards, because like the honorable mentions here, it's Hoovy, Jean-Pierre Lafitte, Tom Pritchard, Foligno, Chris Jericho, Taka Michinoku, Johnny B. Badd, Steve Regal, D'Lo Brown. That's just a really interesting collection of names for most underrated.
Yeah, because like 95, D'Lo Brown was just like working Jersey, right? Like it was...
The dying days of Smoky Mountain.
Right, yeah, because like, geez, we're like getting to the point of Reckless Youth being a constant fixture looking at this list. And then, like, yeah, Jerry Lynn making this list, like, someone that I'll be talking about a lot when we get to our own picks for this year.
Mm. Reader's personal favorite wrestler. This was won by Minami Toyota. Second place, Shawn Michaels. Third place, Rey Mysterio Jr. Notable finish for Sabu in seventh. And then your honorable mentions include Jushin Thunder Liger with 20 points, Bret Hart with 15, Al Snow with 14, Sandman with 9, and the great Sasuke with 9. So you still see, despite Sasuke not really placing in Flair Thez this year, most outstanding this year, still an honorable mention in Reader's Favorite Wrestler. I will continue to Best Gimmick and then get your thoughts on both of these, Mike. Best Gimmick, talk about aging poorly. 1995 Best Gimmick winner, Disco Inferno. Raven, Undertaker, Goldust, El Santo Negro, your top five. But we mentioned this because Super Delphin finishes as an honorable mention with 13 points, which I thought was really interesting because I think between 93, 94, 95, this was probably the weakest Delphin character year there was.
Yeah, I think 1994 Delphin is incredible. Mm-hmm. Like, it really doing the best version of Lucha-esque Ric Flair. And you still get, like, the tailwind of it in 1995. But he's just, like, one of, like, the C stories or D stories, if we're talking about 1995, is really, like, okay, we talked about how in 93, 94, like, you were basically focusing on Sasuke, Shinzaki, Delphin, or Sato. But Delphin didn't go anywhere. Delphin's all over 1995. He's just, like, being frank, like, he's at a point where he's just either being lapped by people like Taka or getting caught up by people like Taka, or it's just, like, him having a very, like his storyline is not happening, so Delphin is just kind of along for the ride here. So that's just a wild kind of thing with this. I forget, who was El Santo Negro?
What a great question. I should know that off the top of my head, but I don't. I don't know if they're just referring to the Santo heel turn here or if they're referring to, no, Espanto Jr.
Espanto Jr. Okay. Yeah, then no, that makes sense here. And then Reader's personal favorite here. I mean, when you, like, think about, like, the tape trader thing, like, other than Sasuke having, like, the tournament, and we talked about the quote from Jeff Lynch about how that wasn't necessarily, like, the kind of mover, like, Sasuke not being on J-Cup probably knocked him out of this top 10 list.
You know, I hadn't really put much thought into El Santo Negro finishing fifth, and he would have been wrestling as Pentagon for AAA in 1995. If one of the smart Lucha people are listening to this podcast, if you could tweet at us and sort of explain why he might have done so well in the voting, I would really like to know, because he doesn't. I mean, he works 40 matches for AAA in 1995, which I guess if, you know, all of those were on TV, that's a pretty full schedule. But this does feel like it hit a blind spot for me where I have no idea why or how he could have finished that well, because it's not. It's not a run that I have any knowledge of. That's really interesting. And that, again, that would have been Pentagon in 1995 AAA. I would like to know more about that.
Yeah, that one just raised my eyebrow when I saw that. When you read that off, was like, okay, El Santo Negro. I'm not familiar with that. And I knew 95 for AAA with that. But yeah, no, that's interesting.
Wow. Yeah, no, this is, I'm going to have to dive in here. It looks like there's a TV match. March 2nd, 1995, Eddie Guerrero, El Santo Negro, and Psicosis versus El Hijo del Santo, La Parca, and Octagon. That, at the very least, seems like something I would like to watch. That's interesting. Well, if any smart Lucha people are listening and they would like to explain that, please do, because I'm now very intrigued. But that brings us to the end of Michinoku Pro's placing in the 1995 Observer Awards. So again, Best Flying Wrestler, Most Underrated, Reader's Personal Favorite Wrestler, Best Gimmick. Those are the awards that are represented by Michinoku Pro. Just as a reminder, 1994, Sasuke finishes an honorable mention in Flair Thez. He finished number 4 in Most Outstanding. He won Best Flying Wrestler. Sasuke versus Wild Pegasus was number 3 in Match of the Year that year, with Sasuke versus Shinzaki and Sasuke versus Liger finishing as honorable mentions. Sasuke won Best Move, and he finishes an honorable mention again for Reader's Favorite Wrestler. So I think just by proxy of, as we've sort of talked about, the visibility of the J-Cup and what that did for 1994 Michinoku compared to 1995, where they're not partnering with New Japan, and the Masked League sort of gaining traction as time goes on, It just seems like it's almost one of those things where, you know, Dave is on the Toryumon beat in 2001, and by 2003 he's hardly covering the promotion, and you see it reflected in the awards that year. And I think 1994 to 1995, Michinoku Pro was the same thing.
Yeah, and I think you see kind of like the notable difference now than 1995, when like they are still kind of covered at a level, but it's not to the level 1994, and then we'll see as 1996 how they're covered in their kind of peak year for them. But Case, let's talk about our takeaways from 1995. A real interesting kind of year. I think, like, how do you want to go about this? I know we have our three personal wrestlers of the year and three matches of the year.
Give me your three matches, 3-1, and then we'll do wrestlers in the same order after that. I'm curious to see if ours are going to be the exact same.
Okay, so my match three is the title match of Sato versus Delphin. My number two match is the Fukumen Mask League final, Sasuke versus Karis, number two. And my match of the year was the Fukumen Losers match, Mascara contra Mascara, Grand Nanawa versus Golgotha Cross.
Very interesting. I only have one of those matches. All of my matches are from the same tour, which I found to be funny. My number three match would be Sasuke versus Delphin from August 12th, 1995. My number two match would be Sasuke versus the Convict from August 13th, 1995. And my match of the year would be Cross versus Nanawa from August 25th, 1995. As it stands right now, that Cross versus Nanawa match is my number two match in Michinoku Pro history, behind the six-man tag at Cork and Hall from February of 1994, which I know I like much more than you do.
Yeah, I'd say Nanawa and Golgotha would be behind Shinzaki and Terry Boy for me, for like my top matches at this point.
Is that your top pick through 1995?
That match left a mark on me that nothing so far has like replicated.
Yeah, that's fair.
And I've gone back like since and have rewatched that match. I think that there's something very primal about that match at Mockland. And I felt like that level of primality, maybe not necessarily there in Nanawa versus Golgotha, but it just, to me, it was maybe just like a shockingly great performance from Nanawa. And in a tournament where it kind of came out that he had, at least for me, a lot better performances than someone like Delphin, who should have been in a position to, you know, come out as the number two of the Michinoku side, and that's not how Fukumen kind of played out.
I would agree with that, and so I think that's a very fair assessment there. Give me your wrestlers of 1995, 3-1.
So number three is Grand Nanawa. He really just comes alive in that league, and especially also with the match with Sasuke, I thought was remarkable from him as well. Number two is Taka Michinoku. I think that there is a real possibility that if someone who was going to the shows and especially got to see the Futari Tag League, there's a chance that Taka Michinoku should be number one, but we just don't have the ability to say that with the footage that is on tape. And then number one is Sasuke. I think that Sasuke, given the fact that they had to audible out of a year that really felt like it was going to be about Sato and the rise of Kai and Tai. And the person that they kind of relied on to get them through that and the most consistent performer throughout the year ends up being the great Sasuke for me. So number three, Grand Nanawa, number two, Taka Michinoku, and my wrestler of the year for Michinoku Pro in 1995 is the great Sasuke.
We have the same order. I thought I might be able to sneak one past you with Nanawa at three, but as soon as you started talking about him on this podcast, I realized that you were going to have him in that spot as well, because it's not only the great performance of the Mask League, it is, you know, a match like Sasuke and Hoshikawa versus Nanawa and Taka from May 14th, and then that Tag League Finals where he is so great, Sasuke and Kato Kung Lee versus Nanawa and Delphin. It's a really impressive year for Nanawa. I think that is maybe my biggest takeaway from 1995, is just how good and how important he was in that year. And that is certainly not something that I had correlation with as we began watching this 1995 footage.
Yeah, and it really, the person you kind of look at when you look at these lists is the fact that we barely mentioned Delphin at all whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And I think that really might be the underlying story of 95, and especially as we turn to 96, especially given what will go on in 1996 for Delphin, I am really looking to see if this guy's going to have that bounce back.
And to 1996 we go. Mitch Doku Pro begins their 1996. We go to The Observer. This is on January 2nd. I just have this note here because I like that now we're at a point where we can start to see patterns in the Mitch Doku Pro schedule in the same way that we now have patterns in the Dragon Gate schedule. And so we know that going forward, they're going to do a big show at the Nakajima Sports Center in Sapporo in January. They'll take their winter break. They'll come back with a big show in Osaka in March, likely headlined by a big Delphin match. And that's the exact timeline we're covering here. And so I just have this note from The Observer on January 2nd that says Mitch Doku Pro has a show on 110 at the Sapporo Nakajima Sports Center, headlined by Great Sasuke and Giant Zebra, who is Kenji Takano, versus Mr. Pogo and Grand Nanawa. And Dave also notes that Battle Arts' Yuki Ishikawa, who mainly does shoot style, works under a hood as the Kamikaze, teaming with Tiger Mask against Shoichi Funaki and Taka Michinoku. And then also this note from the next week, in which Dave notes that in 1995, Michinoku Pro increased their house shows from 121 in 1994 to 134 in 1995, with an increased average attendance of 908 to 934, which is 2.9% growth.
And when we think about Sasuke Soars looking for the 500 attendance, they have now really have boosted from it. But it is something where I think you look at these shows like Sapporo, Osaka, the Oda shows, and then the bigger shows in Tohoku are the ones that are kind of bolstering it up there. And I imagine if we took the data and looked a little bit more into like the median and where things go on this, it is a boost here. And we're seeing 94 to 95, even with the losses of Sato and Shinzaki, that the promotion still shows a level of growth. And I think when you look at the rest of the landscape in 96 and more kind of indies, and especially how the Japanese wrestling landscape has drastically changed since 92, the fact that they're still growing and they go from 121 shows, 134 with their kind of touring schedule is really remarkable for what they managed to accomplish in 95.
I completely agree. A very, very enjoyable year. And that brings us to the first show of 1996. And Mike, I normally throw it to you for these matches, and I will in just a second, but I just have to note, it's so great. You know, Michinoku Pro, they run a New Year's Day show in 1996, which unfortunately we don't get because the main event was Nanawa, Delphin, and Taka versus Hoshikawa, Sasuke, and Tiger Mask, which I would have really liked to have seen. But we go to this 110 show in Sapporo, and your opening match is Sato and Terry Boy versus Masato Yokoshiji and Norio Hoshikawa. This is Sato's return from injury, first match he's wrestled since May. And Mike, there's just something so warm and so inviting and so right about entering 1996 Michinoku Pro, and the first match on tape of the year has Sato Diktogo and Masato Yokoshiji in the ring together. It just warmed my heart to say.
And you get to see Yokoshiji just be a ragdoll in some of the like more brutal and kind of fascinating ways. On this, you essentially get 4 out of the 5 matches on the show on this tape here. I know that he had the bad knee injury, and I've of course seen enough Sato in 96 to know Dick Togo in this, but he comes back and he looks awesome. He is like double the size.
He looks fucking awesome. He looks so good in this match.
Yeah. Like, it's not that we need everyone on gear. We just need to bring back the muscle guts. Mm-hmm. And we have that on kind of full display. And I like the level of seriousness. Like, we got this in Joint in Progress. Like, we get 2 minutes out of like essentially the 8 minutes that we get on this. It's a Kaientai win with a slam and top rope senton. But the level of seriousness that we've seen from Kaientai towards the undercard Sakigun members, given how the note that Kaientai kind of left us in last April of 95, and Sato turning and Terry kind of being along for the ride, and Shiryu not necessarily at that point, but the Kaientai in 1995 might not have wrestled this match with this level of fierceness towards Sekigun that they would have, that they had in 1996. So it's nice to kind of see that pick up on that.
No, I agree. It is just the sort of thing. It's the interesting part of doing a rewatch project where sometimes you just have immediate confirmation bias on what you're watching. And again, it's, you know, Sato and Yakushiji in the ring. It's a really strong Terry Boy match. I thought the way that Terry Boy was throwing around Yakushiji was really interesting because you would expect that from Dick Togo, but you get it from Terry Boy as well. And it's just an awesome way to start the year. It's the type of wrestling that you and I, there's a reason we're doing this podcast. It's because of matches like this, even if it's a short 2-minute snippet of an 8-minute match.
And we continue on with the Kaitai's backstage, basically. Sato's back. He's a big bad man. And we cut to a kind of joined in progress of Shoichi Funaki and Taka Michinoku, the Dream Chasers, going up against Kamikaze Yuki Ishikawa and Tiger Mask 4. And a really, this 1-2 punch was a delight to kind of have on the show because you had kind of the reminders of some of the best stuff from 1994 immediately with the best from 1995 and then 1996, getting to see Taka taking the year and the bull by the horns immediately. Like, this is the stuff pile driver into running kick towards the apron. I thought
it's so
gnarly.
Funny you say that. It's so funny that Taka and Funaki use a spike pile driver as a transition move. That's just like a thing they do in the middle of the match, and I think it rocks, actually.
Yeah, and there's something about Funaki and the singlet doing mm-hmm. this too. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just like it looks right. And I have to say, I other than Ishikawa kind of not wrestling as Ishikawa here and kind of doing like a vaguely Great Muta like kind of gimmick here, I thought that it was a kind of a nice little touch with him in Tiger Mask and kind of being the backup here for Tiger Mask, who's still having Taka and Funaki at his throat, kind of picking up right where they left off with him in 96.
It made me wonder what Michinoku Pro would look like if we had more of Yuki Ishikawa working under this gimmick. Because, you know, he's going to pop up quite a bit. Not in 1996. I don't know if we get him on tape anymore throughout the year. Okay, so we get him two more times. He's on the These Days shows in October, and then he's on the very last show of the year, which is like a Battle Arts Michinoku Pro hybrid show. But, you know, he's around in 97 and 98 and 99, but he's around as Yuki Ishikawa, which, depending on what day you ask me, that's either a good or a bad thing. But the Kamikaze character, I don't know if it would work in this promotion full time, but it kind of works against Funaki and Taka in particular.
Yeah, and the finish is the Kamikaze hold, which is this roll through dragon sleeper. It looks absolutely kind of brutal, and especially like given the fact that like we end with Tiger Mask 4 being able not to be on the level of Taka, but on the right day being able to take him out, he gets a win to kind of kick off 1996. And an interesting thing that I noticed in this match and not in the Kai and Tai versus Sekigun matches, case this is a rarity in Michinoku Pro. This is a show that actually has mats at ringside.
Oh, that's true. I hadn't even thought about that.
Yeah, it's kind of like peaked out with that there. But
well, it's a really big venue. I mean, this is as professional as Michinoku Pro gets outside of running like Sumo Hall.
Right. We should say that the attendance is announced at 5,070 with this show.
Giant zebra, giant draw. I want to note real quick, you know, we've talked a lot about Taka, and look, as we get into 1996, it's only going to be a greater obsession for us, but I feel like for all of the little things, all of the fundamentals that I feel are missing from modern day pro wrestling, and that's something that I've talked about at length on various podcasts, I do think there's been a collective effort over the last year for people to tighten up their Tope Suicidas and their springboards a little bit. I do feel like we were going through a phase in wrestling where all of the dives, while they might have looked visually impressive, looked really light. And I think people are now sort of gravitating towards these like suicide bomber-esque Tope Suicidas that work in a real way. I do wish younger wrestlers would look at what Taka does on his springboard drop kicks, where he is throwing them, and I say this as a compliment, so recklessly and so violently, and it looks really real when Taka does a springboard drop kick. And it's maybe it's just specific to that move and the way that you can set it up in so many different ways, but I don't feel like we have any springboard moves, especially springboard moves inside the ring in wrestling right now, that feel like that, that look as violent as that, or like it's done with a purpose. And I think that's the type of thing that wrestlers should be able to steal and take as their own. And I just sort of wish they would.
Right. I feel like the thing that takes you really aback with Taka, it gives you this feeling of force and propulsion in his springboard. And I don't think you see very many people. And I think Tiger Mask is like the perfect kind of person that he goes up against in this, because Tiger Mask is someone who's able to, in 1996, almost go clear diagonally across the ring on a flying headbutt. Like, it is something like on this roster that they're, I don't know if it's, if it's a part of the magic, or if it's the fact that maybe they tighten their ropes a certain way that lets them kind of get that sense of slingshot effect, or Taka's just really good at that kind of physical emotion. But it is really remarkable to see, because he does it also with like his flying forearm. He has an ability that his flying attacks feel like there's a level of malevolence with them that you don't, other that is absent, as you're saying, in 2026.
Yeah, very much so. I think that's well said.
And then we jump into a really joined in Super Progress. It's a match that goes 16 minutes, but we only get stuff starting from right before the 10 minute mark. It's Super Delphin versus Shiryu. Super Delphin is going for the mask at a level that we haven't seen in a while from our resident kind of mask hunter here. He's trying to tear off all the fuzz from Shiryu's mask. He wins with the swinging DDT and a Delphin clutch, but a real kind of babyface performance from Shiryu, and Delphin kind of not necessarily turning on the ring work, but he's able at least doing like the big territory heel main event kind of thing that you would hope for in this kind of scenario. It's not him looking for a match of the year, but it's him playing towards the crowd in a way that I don't feel like you got a lot of in 1995.
Did you notice Delphin did the Randy Savage elbow drop in this match?
Oh yeah, and it looks so brutal. How heavy
it just—it was just a funny, like, you know, we've watched a lot of Delphin footage in the last year and a half. It's like, oh, that's, he hasn't done that ever. That's really weird that he did the Macho Man taunt and elbow drop off the top rope in this match. It is a, you know, a TV style Michinoku Pro match. My big note on this is not really anything that happened in the ring. It's just, as we again look at footage from 1996 compared to 2026. I just think wrestling would be better off, and this is for Japan, Mexico, and the United States, if wrestling visually looked like this. You know, this is Delphin in Delphin's gear. It's Shiryu in his updated 1996 gear. And I'm just a little confused as to what happened. And I don't know if this is just the decline of trade workers and like hands-on skills and sewing quality going down, which is something I think about cobblers a lot, and how, you know, at some point we'll just live in a world without cobblers. We just won't be able to repair shoes. We'll just have to always get new shoes. And
buddy,
I don't know.
I can give you a cure for this.
Okay.
Bootmakers still will exist.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. You're right. I think about like those, some of those trade skills where it's just like,
sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
But cobblers are going to be okay. Cobblers are going to be okay. They're,
that's good to hear. Cause I think we're one generation away from losing a lot of those things. And I think maybe it's just because when I first moved to Chicago, I was living like very close to a shoe repair place that I never saw anybody in. And I was always just like, oh, like, okay. That's probably a family business that's been around for 100 years. You know, his father and his father's father and his father's father's father, they all repaired shoes, but his kid is going to be a Fortnite streamer. You know, we're just, we're going to lose. So I don't know. And I guess I should ask wrestlers, like, especially guys that have been around for 20 years or so, if the quality of gear making has gone down. I would think with the way that athletic wear has improved, that gear would only get better. But God, you look around and outside of some of your top of the line CMLL guys, like, I don't know, most gear sucks now and nobody looks this cool. And that's a problem with wrestling, is that nobody looks this cool anymore.
Yeah, I think, like, I don't know enough about the mask and gear trade. I wonder, like, I wrestling boots is something I've openly kind of wondered about, just because of the rise of kick pads and wrestling shoes instead of wrestling boots, right? Like I feel like in at least the starting like in the late 2000s, maybe a little bit earlier, like the rise of people just doing the boots and the kick pads, and that being like a predominant indie style, was like the wrestling tree thing that I do wonder about the boots side of it. I do know that there's the tree brand that is always with Dragon Gate guys, and that I know that that's like a shoemaker. I forget if they are Kobe or Kyoto, but they make wrestling boots. But I wonder about boots more so than masks and gear, because I imagine gear wise and especially like this, like people picking up masks and gear as like a side hustle and like as an indie worker still being like a way that those kind of rise up.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm really curious about that. But just whenever, like, because my point is always, because I like this guy so much, but like when I see Lee Moriarty wrestle, it's like I don't know if that guy's made for as handsome and as built as he is. I don't know if Lee Moriarty is that look is made to be on national TV. But if you put Lee Moriarty in Super Delphins gear, all of a sudden I'm like, okay, so that's a superstar. I'd like to see more of that guy. But nobody really looks like that right now, and I think that's a real problem.
Maybe Masato Yoshino is the only person who should have the singlet straps down. Maybe that's also kind of a thing.
That could be it.
But then we had the main event of the show in Sapporo. It was the great Sasuke with Giant Zebra, a.k.a. Shunji Kitano, in a full zebra costume versus Grand Nanawa and the, at least for one night, Dolphin Core affiliate, Mr. Pogo. And it's a new kind of Passion of Sasuke match where this time we got to have, I feel like for one of like the real like first time since the Dolphin feud, people going for Sasuke's mask like the way that Mr. Pogo did throughout this match.
So I'm going to make a statement that might seem very odd to you, but I have okay. I have this Michinoku Pro match guide spreadsheet that, again, I should probably put in the Discord at this point, but I have matches roughly in the 3.5-star range and up that are logged on this by year, and then separate tabs for what I would call good, which are 3.5 and 3.75-star matches, great matches, which are 4 and 4.25-star matches, and essential matches, which are 4.5 and above. And right now, as we enter 1996, there's three matches in the essentials tab. It is the aforementioned Michinoku Pro 6-man at Korakuen Hall, Sato Shiryu and Sasuke versus Nanawa Shinzaki and Delphin. It is the Gorgon Cross versus Grand Nanawa match from August of 1995. And then I also have a match in there in the essential tab that I have as non-rating NR, and that is Onita versus Sasuke from October 30th, 1994. But I feel like to fully understand Michinoku Pro, you kind of have to watch Onita versus Sasuke, even if the match is a little bit of a mess. It is just one of those, it is essential viewing by definition.
Yeah, you have to see Delphin in his helicopter come in. Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm mulling over the idea of putting Giant Zebra and the Great Sasuke versus Grand Nanawa and Mr. Pogo in the essentials category. I can't believe how violent this match was. The spot where Sasuke gets tied to the ropes and then Mr. Pogo blows a fireball into his face is so truly insane, to a point that Sasuke runs out of the arena and falls face down into the snow. So
best
that he,
fireball cell ever.
It's unfucking believable. And then the crazy thing is, and this is both part of the charm of the match and, I'll admit, a tremendous detractor of the match, is that Sasuke, once he does that, he's back in the ring wrestling and not really selling that his face almost got melted off. He's kind of just wrestling as Sasuke at that point. But the match continues, and then Sasuke and Nanawa get hit with one of the biggest fireballs I've ever seen from Mr. Pogo. And then Pogo hangs Nanawa over the ropes with a chain. And the whole thing is not great by any sort of in-ring, the way we look at work rate definition. I'm not even sure it's good at points, but it is one of the few times during this series, as we watch all this footage, that my jaw has truly dropped. At the athleticism of the six-man tag, at the spectacle of Onita versus Sasuke, at the violence of Cross versus Nanoa, I kind of feel like this belongs in that category. I can't believe we don't see gifs of this match all the time.
It is like, okay, both Nanoa and Sasuke, they knew what they signed up for, and they're like, okay, I'm doing a Mr. Poco match, so bring that sickle out, carve me up, we're going to do fireballs. The footage of them in the snow afterwards is wild in of itself, and all the while Giant Zebra is just lumbering around. It is just kind of comical, just like the fact that they put him in a full-on like zebra suit and he's dragging around Nanoa with it. And then so it's a DQ. Pogo gets DQ'd for that giant fucking fireball that is used as a way to break up the three count after a Thunderfire power bomb. And then Pogo just loses his damn mind, and it's kind of just a remarkable kind of thing. I think for like to understand the great Sasuke, you have to watch matches like this, because it's a different kind of Sasuke, and it is just like the fact that 1996 is probably going to be his most physically damaging year that we will be talking about. And it starts off with him eating two huge fireballs and getting carved up by Mr. Pogo.
It's completely insane. I was really entertained by this match. It sort of felt like the best version of maybe Zandig era CZW, where you don't...
Oh, yeah.
What you're watching isn't good. You don't really like it, but you also can't look away. It's different than Sasuke versus Onita, where you're seeing two legitimate masters of their craft who are, you know, by October of 1994, both of them are physically depleted in many ways, but they're doing what they can to have a great match. This is not that, but this is something insane in and of itself.
You know who, if time frames lined up, they would have made a whole lot of sense in this promotion? Mr. Insanity, Toby Klein, and Madman Pondo.
Yeah, I guess we did miss out on Madman Pondo and Michinoku Pro. I've truly never thought about that before, but
you know what's the real actual through line? It's IWA Mid-South. Like, this had like the energy of like not King of the Deathmatch, but like some of the other random deathmatch tournaments that Ian Rotten would put on. You know, like there was like a tag team deathmatch tournament that was not very good, but it was just very, very violent. And it kind of reminded me of like that kind of thing. I had a roommate that our agreement was in that I would get to put on Lucha Rest tapes and like Chikara, like Chikara Tag World Grand Prix, as long as afterwards he got to put on like King of the Death Match or like Prince of the Death Match tournaments. So yeah. I had to consume a lot of that era's death matches.
There's that Necro Toby Klein King of the Deathmatch from, I think, 04. It's the one that CM Punk is on commentary for. That is legitimately incredible. I mean, it's just, it's so, so good as like a, like an art form of pro wrestling. But yeah, it's funny. And I guess this is just the generational difference, because like all of those IWA Mid-South guys were trying to be like Harley Race and Kenta Kobashi. But I think if IWA Mid-South in that sort of, if there was like a group of guys in the Midwest, I think they'd be trying to do Michinoku Pro now and not Harley Race. But you had Punk and Cabana and Hero worshiping an entirely different era of wrestling than what's worshipped now, which I think is both good and bad.
Yeah, it's just kind of fascinating to kind of find that commonality here with this. But
I'm putting this in the essentials tab. I think to understand Michinoku Pro, I think you have to watch. A Giant Zebra is insane. Sasuke is insane. Nanoa is insane. Pogo. It's just, this is one of the wildest things I've ever seen.
And Pogo just like losing his shit afterwards, and like Delphin getting in there going like, why'd you fireball him? And then he in response goes like, all right, it's time for me to choke out Nanawa again.
Oh, and God.
It's just like wild. And then you cut backstage, and Sasuke and Giant Zebra are just doing the standard Michinoku Pro sitting on steel chairs backstage promo, and you see half of Sasuke's face. All the blood's gone away, and it's just like very matter of fact about this. Is like, yeah, no, this was an experience. And I think in order to understand great Sasuke, you have to have experiences like this.
Dave recaps the show in the January 23rd, 1996 Observer, in which he says that Michinoku Pro drew 5,070 fans in Sapporo on 110 for a street fight main event as Giant Zebra, who is a character from the original Tiger Mask cartoon series, and Great Sasuke beat Mr. Pogo and Grand Nanawa. And he also notes, and this is very important going forward, some of the Michinoku wrestlers will change their ring names on the next tour. Sato is now Dick Togo, Terry Boy is Min's Teo, and Shiryu is now Tokyo Jin, J-I-N, which does not stick. I don't believe he's ever been referred to as that.
And I think on like one of these tapes, they do kind of go over this, and Shiryu does take a different look as a part of this, but he's still Shiryu with this. But more importantly, so now we are going forward with Togo and Min's Teo. Terry Boy, as a name, you probably outlived your life a couple years for longer than we expected, but now they are not fully fledged Kaientai Deluxe at this point, but we are on that route with now Sato being fully back and back as Dick Togo.
Battle Arts, the promotion, debuted in Corken Hall on January 13th of 1996. Dave writes, and I find this to be interesting, in the January 2nd Observer, that Battle Arts is debuting at Corken Hall using Sasuke and some of the Michinoku guys as the main draw. I will just let that sink in as we talk about shoot style in the Observer Hall of Fame, but it's placed there as from the beginning, Battle Arts was relying on Michinoku Pro guys to draw. So we get that Battle Arts show on January 13th, 1996. The bummer is that this show makes tape and everything airs with the exception of Delphin and Taka versus Sasuke and Hoshikawa. And I would really like to track that match down, but we just don't seem to have it.
Yeah, a wild show actually. For those who are listening to this in a current time, the person who opened that show, Sakashi Okamura, in 1996. But yeah, no, we missed this. I hunted down the champ forum, and this is the one match they don't have on it, which is a bummer. If there's a full show comp, I'd be interested to find it, because also you have the issue that this was Alpha Promotions at one, and this show is Alpha Promotions, and then they became Battle Arts right afterwards, so it's kind of hard to find it because of that.
Yeah, it's interesting because we talked in the last episode about how there was a promotion called Alpha Promotions that was debuting in Japan. By the time they get to that show, Dave is purely referring to it as Battle Arts. So I don't know when that change happened. I don't know why that change happened, but Dave is referring to it here as Battle Arts in January of 96. As we go along, you know, I don't know if this is something that maybe people that only have sort of a bird's eye view of Michinoku Pro realize, but Battle Arts and Michinoku Pro are tied together, at least through the time period that we're going to cover. And
oh, yeah.
In the same way that, you know, once Shinzaki returns to Japan in 97, 98, 99, is working a lot of FMW and is working a lot of All Japan, we'll check in with some of that stuff, but we're not really going to cover that. In the same way that we didn't cover a lot of Taka's 1995 working pro wrestling Fujiwara Gumi. As for the Battle Arts stuff, I mean, look, there's a Michinoku Pro Battle Arts joint show at the end of 1996 that we'll watch. There's the famed January 1997 Michinoku Pro multi-man match on the Battle Arts show. We'll talk about that. This will not become a Battle Arts podcast. We'll check in when it's relevant, but it's not something we're going to cover a ton. Like, you know, the main event has Funaki in it. It's Ishikawa and Funaki versus Ikeda and Asuda, which I actually, with 2026 eyes, wouldn't mind going back and watching that. But some of the standalone Funaki, Taka Michinoku stuff and Battle Arts, we're just not going to cover, just as a note going forward.
Yep. No. And with that, Michinoku Pro kind of goes on a bit of their standard January into February break, except for one big thing, Case.
This is the Michinoku Pro UK excursion that happens on February 5th and February 6th, 1996. From a historical standpoint, I mean, I guess maybe it's not covered because it's not like there's anything you really have to watch from the footage that we have. But I'm surprised that these shows aren't looked at as a bigger deal, because as I racked my brain trying to think about things, you know, All Japan has never run a show in America. New Japan, I mean, they ran a show in Russia in the late 80s, but like their Italian tours don't happen until the 2000s. And obviously their US stuff doesn't happen until the 2010s. We're still a decade away from all the Dragon Gate stuff in the United States, and, you know, almost 15 years away at this point from Dragon Gate USA. This is probably the first time that a Japanese group ran official shows outside of Japan, right?
Unless of...
I mean, maybe... I mean, FMW ran some joint shows.
Right,
there's
yeah.
There's that FMW AAA show in Los Angeles, like right around the time of the Rodney King riots, because I think Dave's writing of those shows is so interesting, because it's like, hey, like Onito's coming to America if he can get into Los Angeles, but... I don't know. I feel like from a historical standpoint, these shows are kind of a big deal.
Yeah, like I'm trying to think of examples that became obvious to me. I don't think there was any proper UWF shows in England, even though there was all the Snake Pit and with all of that. I think you would maybe see in Hawaii, maybe, because didn't Baba have like a share in the office there? And that was like always known as like the stopover point. And with that, like maybe look towards like that. But I think that those were all 50th State Pro Wrestling or AWA, you know, but like that's those were the directions. And maybe the other answer would be insane Inoki bullshit. Like there's probably like Inoki doing one of like his freedom and peace shows, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we're going to talk in two episodes about, you know, the Inoki Peace Festival in Los Angeles, but this beats that out just by a few months. But I would have thought, because I it's been so long now. I, if I'm misremembering somebody, please correct me, but I feel like New Japan had TV in Italy in the 80s, and then they got TV back in the 2000s, and the 2000s is when they did those Italy tours. But I feel like there's something about like Fujinami being weirdly famous in Italy in the 80s, but then when I went to check to see, like, New Japan doesn't run shows there in the 1980s, and even if these are joint shows with All Star Wrestling, like, I still think it's a pretty important historical anecdote, because it's something that, you know, All Japan has never done, and it took New Japan a long time to do, and, you know, Dragon Gate ended up doing it, and then, you know, burning out for a number of reasons, but we have at this point, and it especially becomes true in 1997, a global interest in Michinoku Pro, and Michinoku Pro also having an interest in growing globally, which is a very important part of this.
Yeah, and I think you would go and look at like the fact that at least outside of the luchadors, who was Michinoku Pro bringing in 1995, you had Doc Dean and CVJ as like people that had like worked there with that. I mean, the fact that they made the title the British Commonwealth Junior title, I think also makes you wonder a little bit if your eye goes to the, maybe they were thinking about like this with this relationship with All Star, if they were able to kind of look more towards like the wide view and go like, maybe like we'll do more stuff within the UK as it relates to this. Because like, as like, we got into this, like I always knew a little bit that there was some aspect about Michinoku Pro in Europe, but not to the extent of what this was happening in 1996.
Also, and I don't know if this is something you care about or not, because you and I, for all that we have in common, we listen to very different music, but can you imagine how good it must have felt to be in England in 1996 when you're with Blur and Pulp and Oasis and Suede all firing all cylinders? I would hope that as Sasuke was touring around on the double-decker bus, that he's got just the loudest Britpop music in his ears. God damn, what a time.
You know, he probably wasn't, because you saw how he dressed up on this comp tape this entire time. You know who I would have rather hung out with the tour? I'd hang out with Kai and Tai, because they were the ones that seemed like that they would have been the ones that would have stopped over and got like a Music Maker magazine or something.
Yeah, I'm hanging out with Dick Togo, listening to the Elastica record and just having the time of my life. I just, God, it just, I don't know. I gotta... I gotta make my way out there. I gotta mope around Manchester one of these days. It's really one of the only things in life I want to do.
Yeah, and they don't make it to Manchester. They stay around like a certain part of the UK for this tour. Sasuke, like on this comp tape, it's a lot of them like outside of the shows, like traveling around the UK. And it's worth noting that like everyone else is kind of like in sweatsuits, and then like they would have like Hanzo was in a mask and then not in a mask and in like a tracksuit. Sasuke dressed the part, and he was like walking around in a suit and car coat and a scarf the entire time with the mask on, looking very unpleased the entire time to be hanging out with Hanzo, Nakajima, and Tiger Mask 4.
I don't know how you want to tackle this. I mean, the full comp tape, you know, we'll make available to people that listen on the show, to the show. The six-man main event on the second night was out there a little bit, but the full comp tape was not. This was something that we had to hunt down, and thank you to the tape provider that led us in this direction. I guess really the only thing worth talking about to me is the six-man tag main event. Actually, that's not true. The two things I want to talk about are Sato and Terry Boy on these shows working in a way, you know, the easy comparison is always, you know, oh, Ishin reminds me of Dick Togo because of his build. But when you watch Dick Togo in a foreign environment take to it the way that he did, it was so much like Ishin WrestleMania weekend last year. Did you get that vibe from him also?
Yeah, and then also Terry, like this was a big kind of fish out of water kind of experience, I feel like, when you think about Michinoku Pro, because they were wrestling in those typical like British wrestling rings that looked like that it was like a 12-foot ring. Mm-hmm. And the ropes weren't good, like they like showed them like trying to do like dives and stuff, and they were very careful about their dives because of like that. And it seemed like it was only like natural that like when you saw the interspersed clips of like the stuff on the first night, which was a lot of UK versus Michinoku Pro kind of stuff, it did not feel good. Like we had to sit through a Shiryu versus Ricky Knight.
Ricky Knight looked like shit. Holy shit, was he bad.
Yeah, no, he was bad. It was just like bumping and feeding, and that it felt like how a lot of people feel about Big Daddy. Like that's how he was kind of working. Like, but then you would see Sato and I'm sorry, I shouldn't call him Sato here, but Dick Togo and Mins Teho versus Robbie Brookside and Rico the Gladiator, and they work like a natural kind of heel. And it's like very much like, oh yeah, no, of course, these two guys, the one that was doing a Terry Funk cosplay and a wrestling genius, would understand exactly what to do in this environment.
It's really, really interesting to watch, especially on that first show, that 2-5 show. Again, it's a little bit of a mess, but you have this Sato and Terry Boy versus Rico the Gladiator and Robbie Brookside match, which isn't a very good match by any means, but you're overwhelmed with the presence of Sato in a way that I think is really interesting. And as would become tradition with Dragon Gate a decade later on that second show, you get Hanzo Nakajima, Great Sasuke, and who was built on the show. I don't know if you noticed this, but they film the marquee outside of the venue. And Tiger Mask 4 is billed as Sammy Lee Jr. on these shows, which would have been, you know, Sammy Lee would have been Sayama when he worked in the UK, which I thought was really interesting. They wrestle in a six-man against Sato, Shiryu, and Terry Boy. Dave writes in The Observer, 2/19/96, that the reports we received from the main event on 2/6 in Croydon, with Sasuke, Tiger Mask, and Nakajima beating Sato, Shiryu, and Terry Boy, was the best match of the UK in recent memory, and that includes the famous Bret Hart versus Davey Boy Smith match at Wembley Stadium in 1992. Dave continues saying he was told that about 95% of the fans had no idea who the Japanese wrestlers were, but they went nuts and gave them a standing ovation at the end of the show, and that they plan on doing a second tour in April, which obviously did not happen. But I found all of that to be fascinating.
So yeah, no, I thought it was real kind of interesting that like on that 2-5 show, you got Hanzo Nakajima who wrestled unmasked against Tiger Mask. They refer to him as Sammy Lee Jr. And on commentary is Sasuke and ICW, I guess, like the one that are ICTV people, Yukimi Kikuchi. And all they talk about in that match is that the ring announcer announced him as the son of Sammy Lee Sayama, Tiger Mask, the Tiger. And that's all they talk about on commentary for throughout that match. So yeah, it's something that at least they find very fascinating throughout the tape as well.
It's a really interesting match. I feel like, I don't know if you gave this a star rating. I mean, I went 3.75 on it because I do feel like
three and a half.
Because it is a deal where, one, I thought it was a really good Hanzo Nakajima performance. It was really nice to see that. But it is sort of one of those Michinoku matches where the longer it goes and the more momentum they get, you're like, oh, wow, this was kind of going along. And then all of a sudden, before you know it, you're watching a great match.
Yeah, and you have like a Kay Brada that looks like it killed everyone throughout it. Hanzo, like, it seems like that he is like a trusted enough guy to kind of like do these kinds of tours and is always kind of like that hand that like when they need something that he's the one to kind of step up with it. But I guess like as a situation that they weren't getting Delph and Core, so you were getting Kai and Tai, and it's like, okay, who's the third baby face now? And I guess at this point it would be Hanzo Nakajima, and he did step up for that.
Absolutely. No, it's a really good outing from him. It's a really fun match. Again, I think in a very different way than the Giant Zebra match, it is sort of one of those deals that I think is pretty important to see the first international Michinoku Pro six-man tag.
Absolutely. So, and I mean, 1996, that's a decade before Doofixer and Blood Generation 2, if you think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So we continue. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
We continue. The Observer, Dave, notes that on February 12th, 1986, the Michinoku Pro, who usually runs teeny villages, will in the northeastern part of Japan, will run Osaka on 3/15 and Tokyo on 3/16 for big shows. We get this very exciting note on 2/19 that Grand Hamada is going back to Michinoku Pro as a regular starting on March 2nd, so we'll get full Hamada this year. And he also notes that Blizzard Yuki, the alter ego of Saki Hasegawa, will be doing her final match with the gimmick on a Michinoku show on 3/15. And on that same show, Pantera from EMLL will be brought in to defend his UWF super welterweight title against Delphin. Before we break down that show, I do want to note that in the March 11th, 1996 Wrestling Observer newsletter, we get the announcement that Jinsei Shinzaki is returning to Japan. As Dave writes, New Japan Pro Wrestling held a press conference on March 4th to officially announce it would be holding its second Tokyo Dome card of the year on April 29th. The show will take place at the annual Fukuoka Dome show. The show will take place instead of the traditional Fukuoka Dome show that takes place on the first week of May. The apparent reason for the switch is that over the past few years, New Japan has put out lineups for the Fukuoka Dome, which is in a much smaller city than Tokyo, far from any other major city in Japan, that would easily sell the Tokyo Dome, but in Fukuoka, they were drawing in the 50,000 range. And he announces that on that show, you will not only get the great Sasuke versus Jushin Thunder Liger, but you will get Jinsei Shinzaki versus the great Muta.
Yeah, this might be a time where we talk about some of the other things that we've been getting up to in those days, and what Jinsei Shinzaki was up to in part of his time in the United States, as Shinzaki now is turning his head back towards Japan after his 1995 in the WWF.
So we will, I'm gonna do a production meeting on the air with Mike just because I'm looking at the time and I'm looking at the rest of my night. So Mike has graciously translated large portions of a Jinsei Shinzaki book that we will dive into on the next episode, because there's a lot of talk about that Muta match in that book and also his time in the WWF, right, comparing it to Michinoku Pro, leaving WWF. I want to get to all of that the next episode. I think we can do a whole big segment there, and we'll skip over it for now, just because I'm looking at the time and looking at my night and what I still have to get done, and I don't want to get bogged down by a ton of that Shinzaki stuff right now. But
yep, let's move on.
It is very interesting to me. I'll say this. I'll say this now instead of saving it for the These Days episode when they get to Sumo Hall. Do you realize that Shinzaki, when he comes back to Japan, he works Muto in April, and then he does not wrestle again until October 10th, 1996 in Sumo Hall?
Yeah, and at least like through his book, it's a lot more of a kayfabe thing without getting like too much deep into it. Like, it's still like he essentially, like, he's done with WWF in this time, and he goes back to Tokushima and he's living with his grandparents. Like, and he's just not wrestling. And he said he's trying to figure out his next step. Like, again, it's like kind of like a kayfabe thing, but it's a wild kind of thing that like he leaves and he does like these two matches. And then that's essentially his 1996. After that point, he's doing a lot more All Japan after that.
Yes. And so we will obviously dive into Shinzaki leaving the WWF and that match with Muta on the next episode, as well as Sasuke versus Liger. That's on the watch list as well. So some big New Japan stuff coming up there as we get back to a partnership between New Japan and Michinoku Pro, which I don't fully understand why it went away to begin with, but in 1996, it's back. And sure enough, it ends up being incredibly beneficial for Michinoku Pro.
I think it's literally the fact that Liger got hurt and he couldn't say, no, we need to be doing stuff with Michinoku Pro.
Yeah.
I think that might be it.
It goes back to the Ricky Choshu story of him watching Taka during the J Cup and being like, what? Like, what is this? What am I watching right now? And sure enough, you know, Liger was there to put him in his place. And then Liger is not on the road. And all of a sudden, no Michinoku Pro. And as a result, you know, it's funny the sort of void that 1995 can fall into with the junior heavyweight wrestling, because All Japan never specialized in the juniors. And so they don't, you know, All Japan 1995 is historically great, but not because of the junior heavyweights. But when you look at the greatness of 94 and the greatness of 96, both in the context of the New Japan juniors and of Michinoku Pro, what's missing? Jushin Thunder Liger calling the shots, or a partnership with Michinoku Pro and New Japan Pro Wrestling. It's just amazing the void that 1995 falls into.
Yeah, no, it's kind of remarkable.
Incredible. So we do have one more show to cover here. This is the 315 show in Osaka. And before we get there, because that show, it's in Osaka, so of course it's headlined by a big Delphin match, which again, I like that we're far enough in this series now to where, you know, 1994, it is Mask versus Hair, Sato versus Delphin. 1995, it is a title match where Sato finally wins. And then this year, we get Delphin versus El Pantera for the CMLL World Welterweight title. But we have to talk about that CMLL World Welterweight title for just a second. So we go back to the Observer, and we go back to January. This is from January 23rd, 1996, in the AAA section, in which Dave writes, the Moreno family is leaving the EMLL fold along with Juan Herrera and helping this group, meaning AAA. A key to this deal is that Ultimo Dragon is part of the family, and he was at a combined show in Nakapon over the weekend and is said to finally be quitting EMLL. Dragon said that he wouldn't be going to ECW because he's in too much pain to do what would be necessary to get over there. He's got so many injuries now at 29 from all the craziness of his youth that he looks back at the wrestling business and feels he can probably last one more year in Japan before he'll take it easy in a toned-down style in Mexico. Pausing there for a second, Dave kind of nails that. You know, Ultimo Dragon in 1996, that's his last hurrah in Japan.
Right. And when you think about how he gets that WCW deal, like, he realistically, and also you put in context, like, the Mexican economy at that time, it makes a lot of sense that Ultimo is looking around and going, like, okay, I don't think I'm able to keep up anymore in Japan, but there are these other avenues. And of course, WCW becomes like the big avenue. And then of course, what happens with his elbow injury there changes everything completely. But when you think about like him at 29, it also makes you like think about what he was doing in Hamada's Universal at 21. Basically, it does kind of make you go like, holy shit, this guy already, like, if you're looking at like a 10-year period and like the stars of Japan and in Mexico, like, he would be on that top five list, but it's just never worked out cleanly with like decades like this. And already at 29, looking into his 30s, he's already thinking about what will be next for him.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I think what's so interesting about Ultimo is just how short that prime actually is, and I include Unmasked Yoshinori Asai in that prime, which a lot of people do not. Dave would continue on the 23rd, noting that Paul Heyman saw a tape of the 7-7 Dragon versus Chris Jericho match of the year from Japan. It was interested in bringing them in as a feud. That does not happen, but that would have been nice to see in ECW. So we jump ahead to the AAA section. This is on March 8th. And Dave writes that Octagon brought out Pantera from EMLL and talked about him being a new partner. It looks like Octagon, Pantera, and Ultimo Dragon will become a regular trio. Pantera came out with the CMLL welterweight title and said he was giving back the title because he is joining AAA. And that, to me, is fascinating. We do not see that anymore, of guys jumping promotions as champions, jumping with titles at some point. And so that means that this match in Osaka on the 15th is Super Delphin, Michinoku Pro Wrestler, does not work for CMLL, versus Pantera, AAA wrestler, holding a CMLL World Welterweight title, and Delphin wins what is essentially an unsanctioned title match to put the belt on him now.
Yeah, no, Delphin pays for this. Like, it's very, very clear. And he celebrates like someone who just paid for a title win. And someone who like, come and bring him like his own resplendent jacket because he didn't get a Super J Cup jacket. So he gets a special pink Delphin mask in or jacket in Osaka for winning this belt. This is, though, on like a certain course with Delphin, because like the whole situation, like the UWA belt, like at a certain point, I feel like Delphin in the 90s like ends up with like these belts that it feels like that. And in this case, I know that there's like resolution and things kind of going along with that, but it does kind of give an air that Delphin is someone who buys title belts. And that's what it kind of feels like, that he kind of does this as a way to, you know, have a big homecoming show for him.
It's really interesting business that you just know in March you're going to get a really big Delphin match in Osaka at some point. I mean, I was looking ahead to, you know, what they do, say, in 1997 and beyond. And so, you know, March of 97, they're back in Osaka, and it's a big, you know, that is I believe that's when they do the gauntlet style matches between Kai and Tai and the Sekigun, but you get a big Delphin versus Shiryu match on that. So then you jump ahead to 1998, and it's once again a really big Delphin match. That one is Hayabusa and Delphin versus Nanawa and Tiger Mask. And then, you know, things happen, and for some reason they don't return to Osaka for a few years after 1998. Delphin no longer in the picture. But I do love that became tradition, almost in the same way that we know we get a big Dragon Kid match in Aichi every year, just to have, hey, it's March, it's Delphin, it's Osaka, you're going to get something big. I think the bummer is that despite loving Delphin and despite really enjoying Pantera as a wrestler, these guys wrestle so often and they don't really have a classic match with one another. I mean, this match is good, but they make tape so often with one another, and I don't know if they ever had a truly great match with each other.
Yeah, no, I mean, this one, I was 3¾ on it. I don't think that it, for the feud and like the legacy that Pantera has in this promotion, that this really is indicative of that, but like it was a smooth and nice match. And I mean, it did have like a situation where you had Delphin win with a Japanese leg roll clutch, and after a little bit of a kind of not necessarily like his bent of the passion of Sasuke match, but it was him like appealing to his hometown and being like the hometown guy that gets a big win in his hometown. And Pantera, look, like it was solid enough there, but it just did not have a higher gear that really that you were seeing in with him against Sato. And it really, other than like my enjoyment of the Delphin character and all of that, he is someone that like I have such a frustrating time with, because this is like the situation where you think he would have like maybe the best match on this show. And no, I think that the Nanawa and Dream Chasers six man against Sasuke, Shiryu, and Tiger Mask 4 was better than that.
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, you know, this is a three match show from what we get on tape. Sadly, we do not get Hamada and Hoshikawa versus Dick Togo and Mince Teo in any sort of real way. But there's the Blizzard Yuki versus Chaparita Delphin or Asari match on this show, which is very enjoyable for what it is. But
Asari is a lot of fun whenever she kind of pops up. And Hasegawa,
I really like Hasegawa stuff. From my limited, yeah, 90s Joshi viewing, I like her a lot.
And she's been fun in her other appearances when she was on, when she did the tag match with Delphin, mm-hmm, too. Yeah.
But so this
It was nice to do, to kind of have like that. But the semi-main event, as you're about to get into, is what you kind of, I would take away as the best thing that over at this episode of those days by far.
Yeah, I mean, the semi-main event on this show, I think, is historically one of the more important matches in the history of this promotion. I mean, this is maybe not quite as dramatic as the Naruki Doi heel turn and joining Blood Generation in January of 2005, but when you're in a rewatch project and you know what's around the corner and you know what's coming, I mean, this is the match that gets the ball rolling on everything. Nanawa Funaki and Taka versus Shiryu the Great, Sasuke and Tiger Mask, 22 minutes, 22 seconds, and just a thrilling six-man tag.
Yeah, and the story of this match ends up being that even though Funaki's not a former member of Delphin Corps, they are the heel style side is still in lockstep, and Taka and Nanawa work well with him, and they are able to get through this match. Sakigun does not get through this match. There's constant misfires of Sasuke and Tiger Mask 4 against Shiryu throughout. This is Shiryu for the first time wrestling without his mane and in what we now know as kind of his heel mask in this match. The closing stretch was another big breakdown from Shiryu going for the constant misfires usually were from like lariats and from and duck downs from this, but it allowed Shiryu to be by himself eating a fisherman buster from Funaki, a Michinoku driver from Taka, and then a top rope splash right on top of Ryu to get the win for the heels. Kai and Tai hits the ring right afterwards. Delphin Corps content to kind of not get involved in the situation, slink to the back, and Dick Togo and Menseho essentially appeal and get Shiryu fully on their side. He refuses and shoves down handshakes from Sasuke and Tiger Mask, trying to put them back on the same page here, and he leaves with Dick Togo and Menseho to finally have Kai and Tai as a group distinct from Sekigun at this point.
Yeah, it's crazy that this is the best performance Shiryu has up to this point in his career, and it just so happens to be this match. And it's not the hardest, most aggressive of turns, but it is very clear when you leave this show that Shiryu has made a choice, and he's aligning himself with Togo and with Teo over Sasuke and Tiger Mask. But again, it's not this dramatic, super hard turn yet. You can just tell that something is going to happen, and I really like the way that they did that. I don't know if subtle is the right word, but again, they did not beat you over the head with it. A really strong turn there. As for the match, I mean, my God. You know, the thing that jumped out to me here, the thing that I love is, my favorite spot of the match is Sasuke going for like a powerbomb on Taka Michinoku, and Grand Nanawa drop kicking Sasuke's leg. And Sasuke, I don't know if it was just the best drop kick in human history, or if Sasuke just sold us in a way that you thought his leg would have to be amputated after this. I mean, it was so brutal in the way that it looked, but I think everybody brings it. It's the best Shiryu performance. It's a great non-Daredevil Sasuke-style match. Taka, we've talked about a bunch. Funaki is just right in there doing his thing. Oh God, this is just my style of wrestling.
I think for me, like, I know we were talking about like how we kind of position where we are on this journey, but having like fully online Funaki just be an absolute prick and not giving up after Sasuke. Did you end up watching the Funaki versus Sasuke match?
I did 95? Not. I have not seen that singles match yet. No.
I just love the fact that the Dream Chasers are basically like two piranhas in lockstep, that like Funaki is clearly not through with Sasuke, and I love that kind of aspect of not fully moving on from a feud afterwards, and the kind of the lingering kind of thing that this is a real kind of hopeless moment for Sasuke, because at least like Delphin and his bums were one thing, but this is like the Michinoku Pro kind of locker room, in the way that it kind of felt like you had Sasuke as like the big leader, and now it's like fully in doubt. And I love how, I don't know if I would say it's subtle, but I love like the idea that if you have watching these shows now for 13 episodes, and you get kind of an appreciation of like, okay, this is how this is all supposed to work or play out, and now you're starting down this turn, and it's not that that they immediately come to blows. It is the fact that, like, without as many words, like Shiryu going like, you know what, I am perfectly fine, like, now fully following Dick Togo and not listening to what you have to say, Sasuke, after the way that you two put me through with that match. I thought that that was just brilliant storytelling.
I completely agree. I would call this a 4-star match. I think it's one that everybody needs to go check out.
Yep, I was 4-flat on that as well.
Mike, that takes us to the end of episode 13 of Those Days. Episode 14, unless there's anything else, is there anything else you want to bring up before we run down what's coming up next?
I just think we need to, like, underline the fact that Delphin gets, like, this Wildcat belt, essentially, for his homecoming, and he makes a real big deal out of it.
Well,
and
the good news is there's plenty more of The Observer on that next episode.
Hell yeah. These are the things that I love about pro wrestling, Case. It is finding little projects, coming across 30-year-old, like, little autobiography books, and it's finding out weird title minutiae. I can't wait to talk about that next episode.
No other podcast is breaking down 1996 CMLL World Welterweight title happenings, but this is the podcast to do that, for better or worse. As I say it out loud, I wonder if I've made some horrible mistakes in my life. But episode 14 of Those Days is going to be a doozy. We're gonna try to go, and again, this is where some of these episodes might get to a point where that we have to cut these in two, and if we do, we promise we'll try to record them, these two-parters, as close as we can. But the plan for the next episode is to start on March 16th in Tokyo at Ota Ward and go through the end of June. We're going to get New Japan along the way, the return of Jinsei Shinzaki, Yone Genjin, and CMLL, and some of the most important matches in the history of Michinoku Pro, all on the next episode of Those Days.
It's 1996. Get into it, folks. You could follow us on social media at Open Voice Gate, both on Twitter and Blue Sky with that one. You can follow us on Twitter at I'm at Fujiheya, cases at _ in your case. You could follow us in the Voices of Wrestling Discord. That's where we post the match listings and show guides for all of our historical shows that we do over on Open the Voice Gate. There's a pen post with I think now we're quickly getting to a point where it's like 80 time evergreen episodes at this point. Like, by the end of this year, we might be at approaching 100 just with that alone. But other stuff there as well. But that's going to do it this time on Open the Voice. Not on Open the Voice Gate. That's going to do it this time on Those Days. We'll be with you next time talking about the all the fallout that comes from the April New Japan Tokyo Dome show and Yone Genjin and CMLL. Take care, everyone.
My name is Tyler Fornes, and I am one of the co-hosts of the Good, the Bad, and the Hungi AEW podcast here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcasting Network. We take a broad scope approach to the world of All Elite Wrestling and the entire universe of Tony Khan. We talk about the big matches, the big stars, the promos, the storylines. And we also look at it from a big picture perspective. How are things going to change over the course of the next 10 years with AEW still in the picture? How are companies like WWE going to adapt and adjust to AEW? Are they going to be a similar way like they did with WCW in the late 1990s? Will there be a counterpunch? We talk about all of that and more on The Good, The Bad, and The Hungi every week on the Voices of Wrestling Network.